Hey everybody, welcome to The Daily Friend. That's right, The Daily Friend, your daily, or rather your three times a week lunchtime briefing. That's right, everything you need to know about the day during your lunchtime. Guys, this is Big Daddy Liberty, your host of this show. I've got a very full panel today and some faces that you guys haven't heard from in a while. Let me do some quick intros over here, including our special guest that we have in studio, Mr. Jeremy Nell, best known as Germ, the cartoonist. Minir, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Awesome, brother. Good to have you on the show. And of course, a voice who you guys are very familiar with and love. We have, of course, Mr. Gabriel Krauser, writer and analyst here at the IRR. Gabriel.
How's it, Sidley?
Thank you. Brother, man, welcome, welcome. And of course, the head honcho himself, El Jefe, the patron, Franz Cronier, CEO of the IRR. Minier, how are you doing?
Well, 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 and you, Sikhle.
Guys, welcome to the studio. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Hot damn it. We are going to be discussing some very funny and funky topics today and stuff that I think South Africans need to be very aware of, because there is a very insidious creep of individuals looking to control more and more aspects of your lives. Now, we'll begin on the most pervasive place, I suppose, the economy. Guys, jobs numbers yesterday, it's a bloodbath. Record levels of unemployment, 29%, the official rate.
Yeah, it's a terrifying figure to consider that proportion of people who would, and it understates the broader seriousness, but that's the official rate of unemployment.
Absolutely.
The expanded rate will push that up by a good 10 or more percentage points. So that proportion of people in our country aren't able to have the dignity that comes with being able to go out and earn something through their own hard work to improve their own lives. But it was the predicted and predictable consequence of the policies of the government, including the latest drive towards higher minimum wage levels. A colleague in the office remarked yesterday that it's obvious that they haven't implemented the minimum wage properly, because if they had, then the unemployment rate now would be somewhere well over 30%. Mm. And it's this craziness that we live with, Sikhle, in a country where in the face of hard reality, unemployment, structural unemployment of poorly skilled young people, policy continues to drift in a direction that shuts off the avenues that desperate young people need in order to take charge of their own lives.
My big concern here, and you've hit the nail on the head, Franz, that guy who has little by the way of opportunity is living in squalor at the moment and is begging for a chance just to get the first foot on the economic rung, seemingly has very little hope now of achieving that because of the policy environment and the ideology that we're facing with. Gabriel, why? Talk to us about the ideology. Why is it getting us to this point?
Well, I think there's this idea that people need to have lots of stuff first, and then they'll start adding value afterwards. There's this idea that you need to coddle, that South Africans are like children, that you need to feed them and clothe them and take them to the movies and tell them how much you love them. And then if you do that for 20 years, they're gonna come out right. If I can tell a personal story, there are still some avenues that remain open, and I was personally able to take advantage of one of those. When I came back to South Africa after studying overseas, I was looking for work as a journalist. I couldn't find it. But one of the wonderful things about journalism is that you can be a freelancer. So you can get paid 1,500 rand for a piece, and it can take you so long to write the piece that it would qualify as being far below minimum wage. But living in a little one-room hut in someone's back garden and using an outhouse toilet, my expenses were very low, and if I could get one or two pieces a month, sometimes less than one a month on average, I could still get by. But by doing the work, by having that opportunity to do some work, get some reward, I was able to build my own skills. Because coming out of university, I went to a very fancy university, I still didn't have the skills to be a productive citizen. I didn't have the skills to add value to the kind of rate that would allow me to be paid in a way that I could sustain my own life. But I was able to do that because journalism's got this weird thing about allowing the freelancer. If I think of my fellow citizens that want to get into manufacturing, that don't have writing skills but have good skills with their hands and good work ethic, they can't get into those industries because there's no such thing as dignified work, right? That at a starting level. At a starting level, work is always grunt. It's always hard. It's nasty, unless you're extremely lucky. And we don't want to allow people to do work unless it's plush, unless it's everything that you'd want it to be.
But it's that exact grunt work, that that low-hanging fruit, if you will, which people are being denied, you know, by, again, policy decisions which are driven by ideology. When someone says to you, we need to initiate a minimum wage, a national minimum wage, even though the evidence and the data suggests that that wouldn't necessarily address the structural reform required to fix the economy. Franz?
But there's a responsibility that comes with this. If you're going to advocate for a national minimum wage, if you're going to push it, and again in the face of the evidence, and it has the very real result of people not being able to work, you know, you've got to own that. This isn't simply theoretical anymore. And I think a lot of left-wing activists and commentators and academics have a reluctance to own the consequences of the policies that they so effectively push into the public domain. And it's not a broader environment that's going to improve. In the past 10 days, Moody's has downgraded, IMF, let's start with them, IMF downgraded its growth outlook for South Africa. It cut it in half compared to what it had been 8 months ago. So what were they thinking 8 months ago that has changed in the interim? The initial analysis was off. Fitch last week turned its outlook on the rating, which is already in junk status, to negative. Mm. There have been changes that have occurred inside Moody's, I think, which means that they're going to change their outlook to negative and then do the downgrade as well. And yesterday in the car, a chap phoned me about all of this, and he said, well, then all three go to negative, and what then? And what he didn't understand is negative is just the lower basement. You can get downgraded time and time and time again. The ratings are like a sort of skyscraper. There's a ground floor, your investment grade, and then you can go right up to the top. And South Africa did very well in that initial decade after 1994 to improve the ratings position. But when Moody's downgrades, which they're now probably going to do, that's not the end of the road for downgrades. We go further through those various basements. Business Day reports this morning along the lines of foreign investors fleeing out of South African equities to get away. A prominent property economist has reported that there are now more South Africans emigrating, selling their homes, than there are foreigners buying those homes. And this in a week when the land panel, we'll get to that later, has proposed restricting property sales to foreigners because they're buying up everything that South Africans need to have. It's the if you want an upside in all of this, Sihle, and I think it's still quite far away, is that the craziness is being revealed for what it is. Hard reality is starting to dawn. We're starting to hit the wall. Now, I think we'll have to hit the wall several times and very, very hard before people start changing their minds. But it's not all a downside case. A businessman phoned me last night, terribly distressed by all of this. What are we going to do? The new dawn is falling apart and all of that. And I was able to, I think, encourage him somewhat by saying, listen here, it's probably now going to be that process where all the Disneyland promises and economics and unicorns and cupcakes and wonderfulness.
Spaceships. And
spaceships and space-age cities and bullet trains.
Yes.
Literally. Reality dilutes all of that stuff. And you do eventually get to a point, the inflection point. It might have to be an external pressure where reform occurs. But perhaps, as our colleague Russell Lamberti has said, the sort of moment of peak wokeness is now slightly behind us. And the woke analyst community is going to be exposed for the bankruptcy of the views that they've pushed upon the country.
Absolutely. And I think, and I'll bring you in, Jeremy, here, because we've seen it very recently where the politicians may still want to create the facade of everything is fine and, you know, we're on top of this and it's just a challenge here and there. But the reality is the average man on the ground, including individuals who work for the state and state-owned enterprises, are now seeing the consequences of bad decision-making. Danel has been struggling to pay salaries for the past, 4 or 5 months now, essentially taking loans to do this. Eskom, we know, has just reported a massive debt of 20 billion.
Death spiral.
Absolutely. Sichle,
death spiral is the word the CEO used in a briefing yesterday. A word that, Business Day's reporters seemingly didn't hear at that briefing and failed to report in the newspaper. But that's it. No salaries. Mm. Death spiral. Mm. There, you don't put it better than that. Mm. And this is the energy utility.
And then there's also blackout, the idea that SABC was so close to being unable to pay its salaries that they might not be able to broadcast television or radio anymore. So not only will we have load shedding, we'll have sort of communication shedding. With
Given how poor the content is, I don't think a lot of South Africans would complain.
I don't think you're allowed to say blackout anymore.
Guys, I must just sort of pivot this conversation back to this point. France raised the specter of rating agencies also finding a unanimous voice in saying this is a crap show, excuse my language. But the story is a very big one in terms of the effects on South Africans. We haven't really had that conversation in detail. What happens when an Eskom just says, we're sorry, we cannot afford to buy the coal, we cannot afford to maintain, we cannot afford to pay staff? What happens to South Africans?
Well, they'll be bailed out at length initially, and that's already happening. And bailouts mean that they just issue more and more debt. And then the question becomes when, and it's still quite far down the road, when do the people who would purchase such debt, when do they get to a point where they think South Africa might default? Yeah. Along the way, all other types of things come into play. One of those is prescribed assets. Yeah. Trying to fiddle with pension funds. The risk there, of course, is that when you start fiddling with pension funds, the stock market takes quite such a dive that what you thought you had to fiddle with is not really there anymore. After that, you get to quantity easing, as the SG of the ANC put it, which is really the creation of money out of thin air. And you can walk some way down each of those avenues. And then eventually you get to the point where you are out and you've got to decide whether you are going to accept a bailout. And bailouts can come from various sources. The IMF is one of those. Chinese are a second, or I think the Chinese have concerns about the political stability here and whether they should commit their own capital or rather encourage South Africa to take IMF money. And along the way, the currency depreciates quite quickly, inflation begins to rise, interest rates begin to rise as well, economic activity stagnates and begins to reverse, and living standards begin to dip. And in some respects, we're very much in the early stages of that now. And it's a terrible and depressing thing, which is why I'm forced to reiterate, otherwise it's a terrible thing to say, that pressure builds reform. When the Nats were out of money, it was only then a matter of time for the inflection point of the end of the Cold War to begin turning things around. So don't, it's a dark tunnel ahead, but don't just see the downsides in this. It is going to take demonstrating the frightening consequences of the policies of the government to ordinary people for our country to build up the reformist momentum that's necessary to turn things around. And I'm ever more of that view.
And if I can just piggyback off that word demonstrating, something that South Africa sees a lot of is public demonstrations. We have 10 a day sort of violent public protests, but they tend to be very dispersed. They tend to be sort of directionless. They remind me a little bit of the Occupy Wall Street movement where, you know, you'd have literally thousands of journalists going out and saying, what do you want? And people wouldn't really have a good answer for what they want. Well, we want stuff, but how do you want to get it? Well, we don't really know. And I was part of that too, so I know what it feels like. But South Africa has seen public demonstration in a very focused way. When the Zuma Must Fall marches through Cape Town, Joburg, Pretoria, through up to the Union buildings. When those two marches took place, the writing was so hard on the wall that it was clear that by the time Zuma's second term as ANC leader came to end, there was no thought at all of him running for a third term as the ANC president, unlike with Thabo Mbeki, where it looked like he really stood a chance. South Africans can make their voices heard, and I think that, you know, if you think what happens when the currency depreciates, what happened when inflation goes up, it means if you have a TV in your home or just a radio, that probably comes from overseas. If it breaks, it's going to be harder to get new parts. If you need a new one or a secondhand one, that's going to be harder to get as well. If you need petrol to put into it in order to go and buy groceries, that's going to be harder to do. If you don't have a car and you're relying on a taxi, the prices of that's going to go up. When you go to the supermarket to buy consumables that come from overseas, that's going to be harder to do. So there's going to be less butter on the bread, and then there's going to be just less bread, and then there's going to be more angry people. And I think a very important thing is that when that demonstration comes of how poor the government's policies have been, that it, that when people demonstrate on the streets, it needs to be focused. It needs to not just be anger. It needs to come with the sense of, we know why this hasn't worked, and we know what's going to work better. Because if it's just anger, that then can trigger in a series of events that we've seen in Venezuela, that we've seen in Zimbabwe, that we've seen around the world,
yeah,
government put-downs, government repression, increased authoritarianism, and a lockdown further on the economy, and a squeezing of individual freedom as well.
Yeah, but to build on that, another reason to develop the optimistic argument out of the facts as we perceive them now is that when that moment is reached and people begin to understand consequences, we have this wonderful asset that 7 out of 10 South Africans are moderate, middle of the road, conservatives, hardworking, family orientated, kind of God fearing law and order types, who actually have a great degree of respect for each other. And all the sort of social media race relations are the worst they've ever been, and the country's divided against itself, and people want to chase each other into the sea, is gumph and nonsense. The proper decent polling establishes completely the opposite. And therein lies the opportunity, of course, that you must never waste a crisis. And the crisis that we have at the moment is probably the greatest opportunity we've had for a very long time, thinking back in terms of, you know, extended time. To unite that moderate majority of South Africans. They will have the common experience of their lives becoming worse. And if you play the environment correctly, you can use that to demonstrate to them their common interest. And the great unmet challenge of South African politics is to unite the moderate majority, black and white South Africans, who actually see the world in largely the same way. So the opportunity is there. Is perhaps our point, that if we try to seize it now, we can use these horrible events around us in order to start taking some really firm steps towards putting the country in the longer term on a far more positive trajectory.
Guys, just one more question as we move to other topics. Franz, you raised the specter. Of you know, the nonsense and the gumph was the word you used. We see this as the Institute of Race Relations all the time, don't we? In some of the sort of elites in this country who have this weird and are holding on to this weird notion of the new dawn, that just the evidence is not there. And as you think about that topic and a particular letter we got, there is no reform agenda coming. Let's look at the land panel and their recent findings. By the way, this very same president who we're told is Mr. New Dawn.
Yeah, important. The land panel report out over the weekend. It takes a while to work your way through it. I've been briefed this morning by my colleague, Anthea Jeffrey, who's the great expert on these things. And she writes to me as follows. I'll quote the edited highlights for you. She says, the report of the presidential panel will be enormously damaging, encourage the use of expropriation. Even though, she says, the panel says expropriation is only one of several methods for acquiring land. She says they talk about other methods, donations of land, you can give your land away if you want to, purchases of land, where this is reasonable, the panel's emphasis. But she says these donations and purchases in practice are likely to count for very little. She says the sales that are envisaged in any event are not going to be voluntary, but they're backed up by the threat of expropriation, where the owner doesn't agree to sub-market prices for the property in question. She says the panel has supposedly identified 10 limited circumstances where expropriation can be used, such as a property that is abandoned or is held purely for speculative purposes. But she correctly warns that at the end of that paragraph there's a little line where it says the circumstances meriting nil compensation are not limited to the ones that are listed in the report itself.
It's a blank check for expropriation without compensation. Yeah.
She says further that the panel is essentially a blank check to change the constitution and dilute property rights protections. And she says the wording proposed by the panel is inordinately dangerous, Dr. Jeffrey's comments to me, and will allow the adoption of virtually any law to expropriate property in South Africa. She says, moreover, that once this constitutional amendment is in place, then the very dangerous expropriation bill, which makes provisions for custodial takings of land amongst other, and property broadly, amongst other things, prescribed assets and pension funds, should sail through Parliament, and it would only need then a small parliamentary majority or a parliamentary majority in order to pass. She warns specifically that there is a section in the report on what they call compensation policy. Now, in a normal economy, you'd think compensation policy would be a buyer and a seller agreeing on a price. The panel, in fact, recommends something else. They recommend a policy that will range from zero to minimal to substantial to market-related compensation, depending on the circumstances of your ownership of the property in question. What do you do with it? Do you really need it? Mm. Is it income producing for you? How big is it? You know, big landowners should get less than smaller landowners. Entirely so subjective that you essentially dispense entirely with the rule of law. And she says the suggestion is very much that market value will become the exception. Noting to me, does Dr. Jeffrey, that market related is not the same thing as market value. She goes on to warn that the implications are far broader than just rural landowners. She makes the example for me of urban landowners, where the report suggests that all municipalities, in its words, with the input of local residents, should identify, Jeffrey writes for me, appropriately serviced land that is suitable for redistribution. And then the report goes on to write that individual owners of properties that meet the criteria for redistribution may offer their land as donations if they choose to. I mean, that would be the first option. Or they can enter into negotiations with the state, failing which the state may then proceed to expropriate. So as always, a long-term warning from us. Don't think this is about commercial farmers. You see the trouble that doctors are in now with national health insurance and pensioners with their savings, and neither group thought that they would be on the line for a policy that originates from the principle of expropriation long before farmers were. Jeffrey goes on to warn further. I'll end with this point. The panel even makes provision, she says, for the idea of prescribed assets, suggesting that institutions, businesses, financial and the like, should commit to financing. The quote she uses, a specific drive to mobilize the private sector, banks, asset managers and pension funds to respond to the urgency of financing the excluded majority. So this thing goes very much further than some recommendations on the questions of land reform. It is very much in train with the drift of policy over the past decade. It is extremely dangerous. And it doesn't matter who or where you are in the country, the negative consequences of what are contained in this report will come to have a direct impact on your life, your future, and your prosperity in our country.
Gabriel, France, and our colleague Anthea, of course, who I'm hoping, you know, this will be on the Daily Friend website. Remember, guys, you can find all our writing on the Daily Friend website, dailyfriend.co.za. France outlines really a clearly a non-reformist agenda under the supposed New Dawn. And what we're hearing instead is more of the same. In fact, an almost acceleration of more of the same, of politicians having more power and the individual in society having less, the family having less ability to decide the course of their future. That bodes ominous, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's even more to say about the Land Panel's report. One of the things is that they bring up the topic of title deeds and then go through a litany of complaints by traditional leaders. They more or less go unnamed, but they say these traditional leaders don't think the title deeds are good for the culture and good for heritage and so on. And that basically they make the argument that you can't trust poor black people with the right to buy or sell or leverage their own assets. Mm. And this is not a surprise to me at all. If you look at the research that's cited in the report, a lot of it comes from Ben Cousins, who's the leader of a sort of group, small group of ultra-leftist academics who wrote a book last year, the government's sort of the ex officio government's analysis of land reform in rural South Africa called Untitled. And it has a litany of stories of poor black people getting drunk and gambling away their cars and their homes and doing silly things with their assets. And because they can find a few individuals that have behaved in this way, they more or less think that vast numbers, millions, 14 million people live in former Bantustan, untitled South Africa, and they think that these people generally or generically or some significant portion of those millions should not be given the right to buy, sell, or leverage their own homes.
It's soft bigotry of low expectations,
God
isn't
damn it? Man, Verwoerd would read this land panel report, and I think nod and smile at quite a few of the points and think, well, yes, there you have it. You know, this is the correct assessment.
This is the sort of thing.
Frustrating.
Leftist activists need to be called out.
That's right.
How dare you, as a prosperous person who has title to the stuff you own, write a report in which you say that millions of your fellow citizens shouldn't have the same experience of life and the world opportunities that you do, because they're simply not up to it to handle that kind of responsibility. The sort of responsibility that sort of accrues to citizens in successful countries and in Western democracies and the like. And if I take the chair for a moment, I say to you, Sikhle, because I didn't grow up in poor rural backwaters of Bantustans and the like. I mean, you know that world better firsthand. I mean, you know, it's insulting and it's racist.
Absolutely. I mean, I know people, just very briefly, and I'll be very brief on this point. We obviously have plus minus about 150 hectares combined of rural land that we have been farming for generations. You know, it's been in the family, as far as I can pick up, for seven generations, according to oral history. This is land we own, in inverted commas, but we don't own it, do we? Because when I then, as a young, educated black individual, entrepreneurial in my approach, try to start an agribusiness, the very thing that is needed in that part of the world that creates the jobs, creates the income, creates the, you know, property owning individuals who are able to build savings, I couldn't do that. Why? Because I then, you know, hit that brick wall of being told that you don't actually own this piece of land. You don't have the title deed, which your successful white farmer next to you, and again, it's not a feature of him being white, but necessarily it being just a case that we just are denied that right. So I can't start that business.
Now, this panel says to you, you can't. You, Sikhle, let's make it practical. Sitting here, a few feet away from me, you cannot have title to that property because you'd sell it all to buy booze. I mean, that is essentially what this report comes down to. It's staggeringly frustrating that we're still having these discussions as a country 20 years, 25 years into what should be our liberation.
And that's what happens when you have a political elite that simply do not understand what life really is for individuals who, you know, live in, well, everyday South Africa. Jerm, I'm going to bring you in here because, you know, you've drawn a lot of cartoons that point to this sort of aloofness that we have amongst, you know, the elites in this country. What is the sort of feedback you get on your cartoons when you expose how the left just don't understand what life is really like for ordinary people?
Well, I'm a racist and I'm a bigot and I'm a white supremacist and whatever else goes with that. But I do think that there is an opportunity, as Franz said earlier, to also, I think the term would be state-proof. As people see the economy tanking around us and the government doing less and less, it also seems to me that there is a desire to do things yourself. So AfriForum, we see go and fix potholes and go and fix the roads using their own funding. Or very anecdotally, we will, in my own home, find other sources of electricity, whether it be gas or whether it be solar. It doesn't matter. But it seems to me that this kind of mindset could expand and people could eventually create what I believe to be like a parallel economy that doesn't rely as much on the state. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, by default, I think we're getting there. We run this series of scenarios, and one of them is fragmentation, where exactly that happens, as the authority of the state recedes, because it's just too inept, to fulfill its functions. You don't just leave anarchy in the background. Mm. You leave more and more communities taking responsibilities for what was once the functions of the state.
Guys, as last thoughts, remember, this is the lunchtime briefing now. Stuff that we're saying our listeners should be thinking about and reading up more of. Of course, you'll read all of our pieces in the Daily Friend, dailyfriend.co.za. Top two things, France, that our listeners should be looking into reading about right now.
Yeah, I think watch the hard economic indicators very closely and read those against what analysts and advisors, particularly those attached to large institutions, are telling you, and you'll see a gulf that is becoming impossibly wide.
Yeah, I think I'm going to just say not so much what you should be reading, but how you should be reading. You know, Business Day headline poster straight after the land panel report was released said, "Land panel affirms property rights." So think about what that means. Given all the things that you've heard from France and quoting Dr. Anthea Jeffrey and what we're talking about with title deeds, the land panel report affirms, according to Business Day, property rights. And yeah, if you've got wealth managers, if you've got economic advisors saying that the new dawn is still ongoing, you know, just think of that little story about the king who was naked and the massive crowd of people saying, "Yeah, look, his outfit is so awesome." That's the new dawn. Eh?
And adding to that, might I say that I'm very thankful to the government for keeping me employed.
Lol. Well, guys, on that wonderful note, thank you so much to everybody in studio. That was a wonderful conversation. Your lunchtime briefing brought to you by The Daily Friend. Remember, you can find all our news, analysis, and opinion at The Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. Of course, all our podcasts and all our material will be published on The Daily Friend. You can look forward to that, guys. Please support our work. Remember, we are wholly dependent on you. The quality of the work we put out here is because of people like you who donate 90 Rand a month through our fundraising campaign called the Friends of the IRR. How do you become a friend? Well, you can SMS your name to 32823. Terms and conditions do apply. An SMS will cost you a measly 1 Rand. But hey, maybe you're thinking SMS is dog. I am hip. I'm new school. I don't do that. Or then find us online at irr.org.za/join. And you can sign up a monthly debit order over there. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Remember, we are on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Your lunchtime briefing only on The Daily Friend.